Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kelly, your host. As promised, Tim Staples here with us this hour. I have to say, Keith Nestor, one of those people you get to spend an afternoon with him, and you go exactly the same on the air as he is off the air. And that's very, very refreshing. What a nice time we had with him this afternoon. I feel kind of inspired by his joy and his fervor for the Catholic faith. If you got a question about the Catholic faith, whether you're Catholic or not, whether you're inspiring and full of fervor, or you never set foot in a Catholic church, whatever it is, if you've got a question about the Catholic faith, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. There's two lines open right now, 888-318-7884. Tim Staples, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the author of Behold Your Mother, a Biblical and Historical Defense of the Marian Doctrines. Hello, Tim Staples.
Hello, Cy Kellett.
Are you recovered?
I am recovered.
You and Jen are so much tougher than I am. you got back here and then you traveled somewhere else.
Oh, that was brutal, though.
Oh, that was?
Oh, that was brutal because I wasn't.
You weren't 100%.
I wasn't. And so, you know, I get to the hotel and I can't sleep. And then when I gave my talk the next day, I'm not sure what I said. But yeah, I seem to be back now.
Well, I have to say, I didn't go to the Catholic Radio Conference in Alabama, EWTN's, and I love going to that conference. But I just thought, I can't do it. I can't get on another plane after coming back from Australia. And I think I made the right decision because I didn't, even as it was, I didn't handle it very well.
Yeah, yeah. But what a great trip. And in fact, getting out again and I'm getting ready to head out for another trip to Tucson and whatnot. It's just so beautiful. It's wonderful seeing the wonderful folks in Australia and, yeah, you know, just going out again. It's such a blessing to do what we do.
It is. That's
to be
truth.
Able to meet and share the faith with some of the most wonderful people on the planet.
Yeah.
Come on.
I know. 888-318-7884, the number. I'm about to go to phones, but I want to ask you a question, but I don't know if I'm supposed to ask it on the air. So just tell me, am I supposed to ask you about your pilgrimage on the air, or am I supposed to not talk about that?
You know, you can.
Okay.
All we know right now is that our pilgrimage is gone.
Oh.
Yeah. It's due to the war. Oh, it's just devastating because we were so excited. My wife was so excited, but we're working out details right now as to how we move forward because folks have already put, you know, money up and everything. And are we going to move it back? Are we going to try to do something else?
So it's still in the deciding phase.
Yeah, it's in the deciding phase. So those of you who are going with us, hang in there because we're working on some stuff, and maybe we'll be able to do another trip or the same trip later. It's just now it's so hard, Cy, because the war seems to be escalating.
Yeah, like when would you go? Who even knows?
Yeah, that's so, again, hang in there because we'll see what we can do.
The number here again, 888-318-7884. We're starting with Aaron. And Aaron, we're awful glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Tim.
Thank you. Hi, Sy. Hi, Tim. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I am a Protestant. I have a question about, a particular question about prayer in the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
It was for Keith, a former Protestant. Now it's for Tim, a former Protestant. Protestants, we talk about prayer requests. Most of what I hear in the Catholic Church is prayer intentions. And I don't know, so I guess two-part question. Is there a difference in meaning? And if so, is there a difference in practice? Help me understand this.
Right. Yeah, I would say that they're synonyms. Request and intention really doesn't have a difference. So it's a distinction without a difference?
Without a difference, yeah.
A distinction without a difference. I guess intention is important in Catholicism because, of course, that gets to the heart of the matter because your intention comes from your heart. But, you know, as a Protestant, I would say the same with regard to request.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
All right, Aaron, thank you for getting us started. Let's go to Houston, Texas now. Jeff is in Houston, Texas. Go ahead, Jeff, with your question for Tim.
Yeah. Hey, Tim. Hey, as one former Pentecostal to another,
yes,
I'm curious to know how, if at all, you handle speaking in tongues in your own devotion.
Sure. Great question, Jeff. And for me personally, first of all, you know, I would state that the Catholic Church teaches in the Catechism, for example, section 2003, that tongues is a valid gift. It's not something that has disappeared, even though there are some early fathers of the church even that taught that it's not a gift for today. In fact, the church teaches that it is, again, in section 2003. I know there may be a couple more sections, but that's just one section, section 2003 in the Catechism. But as far as defining the nature of the gift, the church simply has not. You don't have magisterial teaching on this. So this is an area where Catholics can genuinely disagree as far as the nature of the gift of tongues. What does it mean? Now, to get to your question about me personally, I do not believe that I used to quote unquote speak in tongues when I was an Assembly of God boy. Have I ever told you that, Cy Kellett?
I don't recall that. I can't remember.
Well, I am confessing now before all the world. No, I did. But upon further reflection, Jeff, especially, you know, after I became Catholic, I do not believe that I have the true gift of tongues, though I believe it's a possibility. In fact, Father Hugh Barber, who you may have heard, oh boy, I wish we still had him around the office, Cy Kellett.
I know.
That man is beyond brilliant. He has taught me so many things over the years. It's just amazing. But, you know, he mentioned to me when we were talking about this, a priest that he knew of from years back. We're talking in the 1930s, 40s, so this was before Father Hugh was born, but that he knew of. How that he was a missionary in Africa back when African countries were first being evangelized and whatnot. So that may have been early 1900s, that sort of thing, Cy. And encountered a tribe, now catch this, Jeff, who, you know, nobody knew their language. They didn't have a written language. And this priest was given the gift of tongues. He simply understood them.
Wow.
Father Hugh said he understood them and helped them to create a written language after evangelizing them. I mean, this is, brother, that's the gift of tongues.
Yeah, that really is. That's an evangelical gift, too. It's not just like for the person receiving it. It's for the good of the gospel.
That's right. That is phenomenal. That's a charismatic gift,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
For the other. So, now, again, I'm not calling into question, you know, other people's claim to have this gift. I'm just saying I don't believe mine was. I believe what happened with me, and this is, you know, we have to issue caveats, as Pope Paul VI did, by the way, in 1968 in his famous letter to the Charismatics, where he encourages the Charismatic movement, but he also, you know, issues some caveats that we have to be careful because sometimes these manifestations can be the result of what I call a spiritual manipulation. You know, people, in my case, Cy, you got to picture this. I'm in a Pentecostal prayer meeting and people are going to town. And Jeff, you probably know what I'm talking about. Just bless Jesus, you know, lift your hands and praise the Lord. And then I remember folks saying, you know, just it'll be like little words or syllables that come to your mind. You just speak it out, brother. Just speak it out. That's it, brother. And so I'm going, okay, and I'm praying and praying. And then it's hundarabakitarabakai. Yeah, you got it, you know. And see, that to me is spiritual manipulation. If you're going to be given a gift by God, it's not going to be because you get pumped up emotionally and all of that.
Right.
You know, gifts of the Spirit are communicated, like, for example, through the sacraments of baptism and then increased in confirmation. It has nothing to do with emotion whatsoever. You receive the gift, period, and then you're called to stir up the gifts. And so, Jeff, what I say is I believe that the Charismatic movement has been tremendously fruitful and in many ways in the Catholic Church and still is because of its emphasis on the spiritual gifts and stirring up the gifts in a true way being open to God and supernatural manifestations. And I believe that's why we've seen some real supernatural manifestations. The only thing I'm saying, Jeff, is in my own experience, I don't believe I have that gift, even though I exercised a quote-unquote gift for many, many years when I was Pentecostal. But hey, you know, we should be open to gifts of the Spirit and moving in those gifts, gifts of discernment of spirit, wisdom, knowledge. Also, I mean, God gives us these gifts, supernatural wisdom, knowledge, for example, of situations. You can be in a situation where your kid is in crisis and you pray and be open to a word of wisdom, wisdom meaning to know which way to turn, or knowledge. You know, a gift of knowledge that will illuminate your mind and empower you to be able to respond to situations. Man, that's for real. That's I think, some of the positives that St. Paul VI was talking about in his letter to Charismatics. But, you know, at the same time, just issue the caveats. You know, don't get too carried away with emotion. And then, because what can happen is like what St. Paul warns about in 1 Corinthians 14. He says, people are going to come in and think you're crazy. You know, if you're not, if all is not done decently and in order, as St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 14. Remember, the spirits of the prophets are subject to the prophets. If you're all out of control and such, guess what? That's out of order. Right? And I always point out, man, 1 Corinthians 14, 37 and 38, where St. Paul says, if any man thinks himself spiritual or a prophet, let him know that the things we are teaching are from the Lord. And if anyone doesn't recognize this, he is not to be recognized, right? So notice, no matter how spiritual and how many spiritual gifts, I'm thinking of men like Montanus in the second century, moved in the gifts of the Spirit, quote unquote, got out of hand, ended up getting excommunicated and taking a lot of people with him. So, you know, decently and in order, in subjection to the apostolic authority, that is, Paul there is saying, I'm an apostle, submit to me. But that means also the bishops who are the successors of the apostles. And then you have the real gifts of the Spirit moving. Does that make sense, Jeff?
Yeah, very much. I would agree with everything you said. It's also the reason that I left the ultra-Pentecostal, you know, group that I was with. And, you know, I pretty much come to the same conclusion as you, with the exception that, unlike you, I still do speak in tongues.
God bless you.
But, and I'm not saying that to you know, sure, to kind of say, hey, but look at me. But you've given me some good thoughts, you know, about you know, I like what you had to say, and it's going to give me pause to think about, you know, about that, you know, because I agree with you. It's very it needs to be discerned.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you, Jeff. A fascinating conversation.
Great,
thanks very much.
Great call. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate Jeff's spirit, too.
I know. Jeff, thank you very, very much for the call. Well, we got to go to a break. We'll take a quick break. Be right back with more Open Forum with Tim Staples on Catholic Answers Live.
Your questions, Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
EWTN's Religious Catalog has terrific suggestions for Christmas gifts. The Prayer Book for Tired Parents, Practical Ways to Grow in Love of God and Get Your Family to Heaven by David and Debbie Cowden will help you develop a home brimming with love, peace, and faith that will help your family become the saints God made you to be. The Prayer Book for Tired Parents is one of many great Christmas gifts from EWTN Religious Catalog. For more, visit EWTNRC.com today.
Back to Catholic Answers Live. It's Open Forum.
That means you can call with any question you've got on the Catholic faith, whoever you are, whatever your faith is, whatever your background is, wherever you are right now, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. If you're outside the U.S., just dial 0 and a 1 before that. Maybe it'll get to us. We never know. Some people tell it. It's a weird thing that people call internationally. Yeah, I can never get through. And other people try it one time and they get through. So let's go to Aaron in Warren, Michigan, watching on Twitch. Aaron, go ahead with your question for Tim.
Yes, I'm wondering, the angels of the Lord appeared in Joseph in a dream. What I'm wondering is, do the demons have the same capabilities, or are they limited and they can't do the same thing like that?
Great. Another great question. And the answer is yes. Demons do have access to our imaginations. But remember this about demons, and the same is true of angels as well. They cannot do anything that God doesn't give them permission to do. Isn't that, that's something, Cy, I think is so important for people to remember. You know, you look at Job chapter 1, the famous case of Job. I love that, how the angels and the fallen angels are ascending up before the throne of God. And of course, the angels are depicted in Job. And by the way, that comes right over into the New Testament as kind of advocates for us, almost like attorneys.
Yeah.
Right? They are advocates for us, whereas the demons and Lucifer himself are, you know, condemning. They're the, as Revelation chapter 12 says it, the constant accuser of the brethren, right? Lucifer, they're saying, what about him, and what about him, and look at him, and I got him to sin, and right? You know, and, but what's amazing there is, I'm sure you know the story, brother, the devil wasn't even thinking about Job. But God says, have you considered my servant Job? I always say
thanks.
At this point, that's right. Gee,
thank you,
thanks,
Lord.
God. And that leads to the test of tests for Job. But remember, so the devil himself or the fallen angels, they have no power whatsoever to do anything unless God gives the permission, number one. But having his, and again, the angels as well. Angels are not just automatons. They are sent, in fact, as Matthew chapter 18, verse 10 says, they do always behold the face of the Lord. That is, the angels have the beatific vision. And so they, like Christ in his human nature, in John 5, 19, remember, Jesus says, I can do nothing on my, that is, the Son of Man can do nothing on his own, but only that which he sees the Father doing, right? He is always in obedience to what the Father is doing, what he sees. Why? Because he has the beatific vision. Well, the angels are the same. And so the angels, they don't make mistakes, Si. They don't, accidentally.
Oops.
I'm sorry. I got the wrong guy, Si. Where's my guy? You know, that's not the angels, okay? But now, having said that, to get to your question, but that is an important sort of backdrop, is the angels, as well as fallen angels, do have access to our imaginations. They cannot coerce the will. And so in that sense, they don't have access to our intellects and wills. They cannot move directly our intellects or our wills. But they do have access to our imaginations, and that is the realm of dreams. Because with dreams, what are you doing? You're recalling the memories and such in the imagination, and that's why you get all kinds of crazy stuff in there, because it's stuff you wouldn't think of when you're... I'm just thinking of a dream I had recently that was really weird. That's why I'm laughing. But I told my wife about it this morning, but that's another thing. So yes, they do have, and that's why we need to pray as... I want to say, yes, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13 and 14, St. Paul talks about casting down imaginations, right? And every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, and wrestling into obedience, every thought to the obedience of Christ. So in the spiritual battle, we have to remember this, right? And we have to pray. That's why we pray before we go to bed. It's very important that we do. You know, keep me through the night. We have prayers for that. You know, that God's holy angels, I pray that over my kids, you know, protect them during the night and so forth. You know, we lose sight of that a lot, Si, you know, that there's a real spiritual battle going on.
Right.
And the devil does want to get into our imaginations because that's where he can tempt us to sin. But does that make sense, Aaron?
Yeah, that's good.
All right, brother. Thanks so much, Aaron, for your call. You know what I have to say? Every once in a while, I like to say to folks in general, you know, with Aaron and the other callers, Jeff, and I forgot the other fellow, it's so important you guys ask these questions because, you know what, there's a lot of people out there that have the same question. And we appreciate those of you because I know it's not easy to call in and ask a question. You know, you're like a little nervous about doing it.
Yeah.
But thank you all for calling in because each one of these questions, I believe, are not just for you, but they're for a lot of other people too.
888-318-7884 is the number. I was thinking that it's very interesting what you said about the demon needing God's permission. In a certain sense, that can give you a sense of confidence, really, because I've heard about these saints where, like, they see the devil and they just, like, they don't even acknowledge him. They just ignore it. And they must just have confidence in God that, well, God's allowing this for some reason.
I know. Remember in Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion of the Christ, where Jesus is on the Via Dolorosa and suffering terribly, and then the devil appears, and Mary is looking at Jesus, and the devil appears on the other side. Remember that scene?
Yeah. And then
the devil looks at Mary, and I love the... I tell you, there's so much in that movie that's brilliant, but Mary looks right at the devil, and you get that sense of Genesis 3:15, right? Enmity between thee and the woman, thy seed and her seed. But she only looks at him just for a few seconds and then right back to Jesus.
Yeah.
She did exactly what you're talking about. It's like dismissive. You know what? You're just a creature.
Yeah.
I'm looking at God.
Right, yeah. Bernadette in Sacramento watching on YouTube. You're next, Bernadette. Go ahead with your question for Tim.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my question.
Yes.
So a couple weeks ago during a Q&A with the priest, the topic of the Eucharist came up.
Yes.
And in a response he gave, he said something like, he asked, where is Jesus? And we said, in heaven. He said, yeah, so his body is in heaven, so his body is not in the Eucharist. I don't want to misquote him too much, but he basically said if that were the case, it would be cannibalism. And that kind of threw me off because I had always been under the impression that it was his physical body, not just metaphysically. He kind of elaborated on it. It was a bit hard to understand just because I was raised just believing that was a given. You know, his real presence means his real, you know, physical true body and everything that goes with that, including his, you know, essence of God and on that kind of a thing. So is it just a physical, I mean, sorry, is it just a metaphysical presence of God, or is it both metaphysical, physical, the whole thing?
Gotcha. Okay. Here's the key. And I could not even think to respond to whatever the priest says, because a lot of times, you know, we don't remember exactly right what the priest has said, or so. Believe me, I've done that many times. I listen to a broadcast, and I think I hear somebody say something. I go nuts, and actually, they didn't say what I thought they said. Right? I think those words didn't mean what you think they mean. You know, it's that sort of thing. But here, what we want to be clear on is what is the teaching of the church, and here's the key. And I'll give you a little homework. I'm just going to give you one paragraph from one of my favorite documents that the church has produced. I mean, it's so beautiful. Mysterium Fide of Pope St. Paul VI. It's a 65 encyclical. It is just brilliant. In section 46, he talks about the real presence of our Lord, and quite beautifully, but he uses the language in his physical reality, right at the end of section 46 there. So what we have to understand is that when the priest declares the words of institution, this is my body, this is the chalice of my blood, there is no longer bread present, there is no longer wine present in that chalice. What is present, or I should say who is present in each of those two species, is Jesus Christ, holy, entirely present, body, blood, soul, and divinity And as Pope St. Paul VI says, present whole and entire in his physical reality, corporeally present, although not in the manner in which bodies are in a place. Close quote. All right, now let's flesh this out a little bit. So the first point is, yes, his physical, in his entire physical reality, he is present. And that means hair, nails, bones, everything. All right? However, and body, blood, soul, and divinity of the Lord. But remember, we're not talking about his what in philosophy we call his accidental mode of being, right? Like Cy Kellett and I are sitting here in our accidental mode of being. Jesus is not present that way. I'll tell you what we're going to do. The music is starting right now. But when we come back, I want to put a bow on this and help explain. What does that mean? His substantial presence versus his accidental mode of being. We'll talk about that after the break.
Another one of these great questions, Bernadette. Hang on. We'll get right back to it. Tim Staples on Catholic Answers Live. Are you scared to talk about abortion? Don't worry. Almost everyone is. You can overcome this fear, as Trent Horn shows in the newly revised and expanded second edition of Persuasive Pro-Life. With a little knowledge and a few proven techniques, you can become a bold and effective apologist for life. Visit shop.catholic.com to order your copy of Persuasive Pro-Life and never again be afraid to speak up. Also available at good Catholic bookstores.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Is relativism dead? It sure seems dead. Each day, new moral demands are made and they are presented to us as absolutes. Everything from transgender ideology to physician-assisted suicide is presented as a moral good that all right-thinking people must accept. But Catholic Answers' own Carlo Broussard says look deeper, and you will see today's moralism is just relativism dressed up in new clothes. Carlo's eye-opening book, The New Relativism, shines a light on how the sacred moral teachings of this age cover up a deep denial of moral truth. Order your copy of The New Relativism today at shop.catholic.com and be prepared to defend the truth against aggressive relativism. The New Relativism at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's open forum. Tim Staples is our guest, and it's always nice when the apologists get a nice, easy question like this one from Bernadette.
Yes.
Bernadette basically wants to know, in what sense is Christ physically present in the Eucharist?
Right, right. And so, most importantly, we wanted to emphasize that, yes, Jesus is present in his entire physical reality, as well as being present, body, blood, soul, and divinity, which are obviously spirit realities because the soul is not corporeal, and of course, his divinity is not corporeal. So when Paul VI emphasizes in his physical reality, that includes body, blood, and that whole physical reality. Okay, but here's where Pope St. Paul VI says, though, although when we talk about him being present in his physical reality, it's not in the manner in which bodies are in a place. And why is that? Because when we talk about being present in a particular locality, we're talking about accidentals, right? And here's where we have to try. This is a mystery, Cy Kellett, right? Mm-hmm. But try to understand the difference between substance and accidents. Because when we talk about substantial presence, we're talking about the thing, whatever we're talking about, its substantial presence is the whole thing. This is the core of what the thing is we're talking about, whether it's bread or the body, blood, soul, and divinity of the Lord. However, substance speaks minus the accidents. The accidental, the appearances are not included when we're talking about a substantial presence. Now, what are the accidents? Well, the accidents include quality, quantity, and locality, right? Now, why do we say that? Because think about it, quantity. I think I've said this to you before, Si. In the last few years, I have grown in quantity. Sideways.
But you also shrunk a little bit.
I have lately.
Yeah.
Yeah. The byproduct of the stroke, I had to change my diet. So I have lost a little bit lately. But over the years, let's just say I've grown outwardly. All right. Now, when you increase your quantity as a being, you don't become another being. Right, because you.
Right, yeah.
Even though Cy's wife may think he looks like a different being.
Well, I
now,
do. I look like a different being than the one she married. I can tell you that.
That's right. But that's what we're talking about. And quality, of course. The older I get, the more my quality decreases. My brain, everything else, you know, seems to be falling apart. But also locality. See, my quality of being doesn't change my substantial being. And my locality, me walking from here to over there, doesn't change my substantial being. And so when we talk about then substantial presence, we have to try to imagine in our minds, because again, this is mysterious. There's a mysteriousness about it. And when we're talking about the mystery of the human being or substantial being or being in general, transcends our ability to fully comprehend. I mean, Si, think of it. I don't know why a brown cow eats green grass and produces white milk. I don't know. I mean, science can break it down to the nano level, but in the end, all we're doing is putting labels on stuff that we don't ultimately understand. What is a quark? I don't know, and neither does any scientist in the world. Nobody really knows. Okay, and so this is what we're talking about. When we say substantial presence, it's absent quantity, quality, and locality. That's why Jesus can be present in a million different tabernacles at once, right? Because locality is not a part of the substantial reality. This is why, by the way, Padre Pio could bilocate and such. You have to be talking about a substantial presence somewhere else. Because if you include the appearances or the accidentals, Jesus can only be seated at the right hand of the Father, whatever that means. He can only be in one location in his accidental mm-hmm. mode of being, in his human nature. But substantially, yes, he is multiplied all over the world. But here's the point, though. You don't want to fall to the error that says, and I've heard others make this mistake. I'm not saying the priest did that was on the air because I don't know what he said, but I've heard folks make the mistake of saying his presence in the Eucharist is not physical. It's spiritual. Or they'll say it's metaphysical. Uh-uh. Well, of course, there's a metaphysical reality to everything. But his presence in the Eucharist includes his physical reality, but not in accordance with the accidental mode of being. And that's why Paul the VI says that he's present. And I'm actually quoting from the document right now. I gave you the homework of reading Mysterium Fidei, section 46. But he says, nothing remains of the bread. He's talking about after the consecration. He says, nothing remains of the bread and wine except for the species beneath which Christ is present, whole and entire, in his physical reality, corporeally present, although not in the manner which bodies are in a place. Because when he's talking about the species of bread and wine, he's talking about the accidents or the appearances. I hope that helps.
Bernadette, did it help? Is it clear?
It did help. I did read up a bit on what you were saying about the accidental and the substance, so I kind of had an idea of what you're talking about.
Good.
Still a bit more complex than.
Yeah, it's not easy. It's not easy, Brenda.
That's right. A little bit of a brain twister, but
yeah, just
it is for sure.
You know what though? Here, just remember, you know, if you're struggling with the idea of substance and accidents and whatnot, I love the clear words of Saint Cyril of Jerusalem, who said way back in the 4th century, when Jesus speaks his word, "This is my body." Nature must give way to the word of God, and nature becomes what Jesus says it is. And I love that, because on a simple level, and this is something beautiful about all Catholic theology, on a simple level, a child can understand it. My kids understand. My 8-year-old, oh, he's now 9, he's getting old. Anthony, if you're listening, I'm talking about you. Anthony understands that when the priest says, "This is my body," that's what it is. Even though it looks like bread, guess what? It's Jesus' body, because Jesus says through the priest. So if we can keep that, we can understand. If you want to dive deeper and understand, then dive in deeper and take a look at substance and accidents, but always maintain the simplicity of the faith. And from there, you can dive deeper. Like the Trinity, we believe one God, three persons, all right? But we could spend our whole lives diving into that great mystery, understanding it deeper and deeper. I hope that helps as well.
Thanks, Bernadette. I'm going to keep moving because there's lots of folks on the line. Jerry's in Texas. Jerry, go ahead with your question for Tim.
Hi, Tim. This is Jerry. I'm a team member of an RCIA group here in Dallas area. During one of our conversations, we were talking about the impact of Adam's sin on the human nature.
Right.
Now, we know the created nature had preternatural gifts of original holiness and justice.
Right.
Okay. And then after that, it was damaged. Concupiscence enters the picture and whatnot.
Correct.
So my question really revolves around Mary's Immaculate Conception. So the way I look at it, now I don't know if there's like, if the damaged nature is just a, you know, and we receive that original sin through propagation because we inherit it through this damaged nature.
Mm-hmm.
My question about Mary is, and I know God preserved her from original sin.
Correct.
But was she bestowed the original human nature with the preternatural gifts?
No.
Or was she given the damaged one, but God just kind of mended it or whatever he needed to do to remove that stain from that?
Right. Yes.
From that nature. So that's my question.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you answered it. The latter is correct. Okay. And in this instance,
is that a church teaching, or
yes,
or is it more of a theological?
No, this is church teaching, and it's rooted really in the infallible declaration, Ineffabilis Deus, of Pope Saint Pius IX. When he declared the infallibility, he defined what that means, and that is she was by a singular. If I'm going on memory here, but in the infallible decree, it says, by a singular privilege of grace, she was preserved free of the stain of original sin in the act of her being conceived. That's what it means. And so there's absolutely nothing about, and she was restored to the preternatural gifts and so forth. And of course, we know, theologically speaking, she was not given the preternatural gifts because she died. Now, I know people will say, well, wait a minute, isn't that still up for grabs in the church? No, it's not. Now, it wasn't part of the infallible declaration. Of course, there are, in fact, if you read my book, Behold Your Mother, I cite for you St. Epiphanius in 350 AD that taught that she never died. Timothy of Jerusalem, another famous homily preached in the 4th century. He also held to that. And there's a very ancient tradition that says she never died. Now, of course, the stronger tradition and more ancient tradition is that she died. And that is the teaching of the church, though it's never been infallibly proclaimed in the East very strongly. You know, the Feast of the Assumption was called the Feast of the Dormition for many, many centuries before it became the Feast of the Assumption. And the Dormition is deeply rooted in among our Eastern Catholic friends. And of course, I point out to folks as well that when Pope Pius XII promulgated the dogma of the Assumption in Munificentissimus Deus of 1950, 8 times in that declaration, he talks about Mary's death. She died, and when she died, and so forth. And why is that? Because this is it's the teaching of the ordinary magisterium. It's not infallible, but it's a teaching of the ordinary magisterium that she, in fact, died. Now, of course, if she would have been preserved in the preternatural gifts, then she would not have died, because one of those 3 gifts is immortality. So I hope that's sufficient. Just understand that the preternatural gifts, integrity, infusion of knowledge, as well as immortality, are going to be far superseded in the gifts that we receive in the end of time, because, of course, the beatific vision, that was not given to Adam and Eve. And the beatific vision makes the gift of mere immortality, infusion, and integrity look like child's play, my friend, because we are going to see God, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, comprehend him, not absolutely, because not even the human nature of Jesus can fully comprehend God. But we will comprehend in accordance with the gift of grace we've been given, as well as our cooperation with those graces at the end of our life. And in that, we will comprehend the entire created order, God's entire plan of salvation. I mean, we will have comprehension that will make Adam and Eve look like nothing, you know. But we have to understand that God is doing this in stages as well. So we have to be faithful unto death in order to attain the fullness of what we're talking about. But anyway, I went beyond your question, but does that help at all?
It does. It helps a lot. Can I follow up with just a real a definition?
Fire away.
If I may?
Yeah.
So the dormition, is that just a general term, regardless of whether she died or just fell asleep? Or is that tied to one of the traditions?
Yeah, it's tied to the tradition of, yes. Talk to any of our Eastern Catholic brothers and they will point it out real quickly that, yeah, that's tied to the tradition of her falling asleep. And remember, falling asleep means death. Like, you know, that goes all the way back to the Old Testament, Daniel chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. Those who are asleep in the dust will rise. That's a prophetic statement concerning the resurrection. The falling asleep is used both Old Testament and New Testament as a sort of a term that is synonymous with dying. And so, again, you have this teaching. And by the way, it's not just a matter of East-West either, although the East, we got to give the East credit because they preserve the traditions really, really well in the East. But it's not just in the East, because you have St. Gregory of Tours in 563 who taught on Mary dying, laying in state for 3 days, and the apostles come and see him. And, of course, you have St. John Damascene in the 8th century that teaches it as well. So it's both East and West that really had this understanding of Mary dying.
Jerry, we got to leave it there because we got to take a break. We got more Open Forum coming up right after this with Catholic Answers Live with Tim Staples on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
In Morse code, the sequence SOS is a distress call. It's been said that it stands for Save Our Souls. Well, right now our world is in big trouble, and we're putting out an SOS call for help. Will you answer that call? St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, has hundreds of teams who share the good news with souls who don't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to get involved.
Hi, this is Mike Aquilino with a few words about St. Irenaeus. It's only recently that Pope Francis has declared him to be a doctor of the church. And this is unusual because he's been dead for many centuries, almost two millennia. But I think he's a man for our time because he's teaching us to think, to have an educated faith, to know the reasons for what we believe, and then present those to a skeptical world.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. This hour is zipping by, I think because the questions have been really interesting. We've had a lot of really good questions for Tim Staples, our guest. It's open forum. And off to South Korea we go, where our friend Luke calls from time to time from Seoul, South Korea. Hello again, Luke.
Uh-oh. Do we get Luke?
Is there a problem?
Did you hit the right button?
I hit the right button. All right, that's a somewhere over the Pacific. That call is not connecting. Luke, hang on, though. I'm not going to give up on you. I'll go to Pennsylvania, which is easier to get to, and then we'll come back to you in Korea after this. Kyle in Pennsylvania listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Go ahead with your question, Kyle.
Hi, Tim and Sai.
Hi, Kyle.
My question is, how can I explain to a Protestant that in John 19, verses 26 to 27, when Jesus says, "Behold your mother," that he's, in a sense, inviting us to take Mary as our mother, and it's not just him giving to John for his mother, and why that's important?
Oh, boy. Yeah, this is a really good question. And, Kyle, I'd like to send you out a gift.
Oh, Behold Your Mother.
Can we do that? Yeah. In fact, Kyle, in my book, Behold Your Mother, I have a whole section on this. I think you'll really appreciate. So if you don't mind, we'd love to send you out a free copy. Would that be okay?
Yes, thank you very much.
All right, and you just give your address to the call screener, and we'll shoot it out to you. But let me just give you a snippet here of what you're going to get a lot more in the book. But in John 19, I think the key in helping, and this is coming from a Protestant who came to see this while I was still Protestant. I was not Catholic yet. Late in the game in my conversion process. And that is after, of course, the famous statement, woman, behold your son, and woman, behold, or son, behold your mother. The key is the next verse. I believe it's verse 28. And from that hour, John took Mary as his own. That's how the better translations have it. But what's really cool in this text, and I got this from Pope St. John Paul the Great. Have you heard of him? He's a pretty sharp guy.
Yes, I have heard mentioned.
And I talked about this as well with my old Greek professor when I was in the seminary. We had a great time going through this. But Pope John Paul points out in his encyclical, Mother of the Redeemer, which I highly recommend, of March 25th, 1987, a brilliant encyclical letter and one of his more apologetic, just absolutely beautiful. But he points out that actually in the Greek text, it's plural. So when it says, and John took Mary as his own, it actually reads eis ta idia, not eis ta idion, which would be singular. It's eis ta idia, which is plural, which seems out of place. Why wouldn't he put it in the singular? Well, he's got something in mind here, because this is not. Now, John Paul brings out that there seems to be a reciprocating relationship as their own, meaning John and the Blessed Mother belonging to each other. But on a deeper level, you also have included all of us, because John takes Mary as their own, meaning in the place of all of us, plural. You want to point that out to your Protestant friend, have him check it out. In even if he doesn't know Greek, just go to a Strong's Concordance. You know, they love that, or Young's Concordance, whatever, and you'll see it's plural. But here is the kicker for me. not only do you see this plural here that's bringing in that, hey, there's more to this than just John, but you also have Revelation chapter 12, the same apostle John. And that's why I say, people, please don't tell me it's John the Elder who wrote the book of Revelation, although most don't say that. Most say that about the letters of John, but please don't, because John wrote the book of Revelation, man. It's got his fingerprints all over it, and this is one of many examples of John the Apostle. Because notice, in Revelation chapter 12, John has the woman who no doubt, and what does Jesus call Mary in John's gospel? John 2:5, John 19:26, right? Woman, both at the wedding feast of Cana and that same text from John 19, you know, as we just mentioned, verses 26 through 28, she's called the woman. Well, in Revelation 12, she's called woman eight times, connecting these. But the woman, you'll notice, gives birth to the Messiah, Jesus, in verses 4 and 5, but then she gives birth to all of us in Revelation 12, verse 17. And she continued to give birth to all those who have the testimony of Jesus Christ and keep his commandments. This is John, but guess what? He refers to them as her seed, which again ties in Genesis 3:15. We are the seed of the Blessed Virgin Mary in that unique relationship between the woman and her seed. So we are all her seed, the seed of the woman. And here we are in Revelation chapter 19. John is declaring we're all her seed because we are all the children of Mary and not just the Apostle John. So connect Revelation 12, 17, where it clearly says the same woman, gune in Greek, that is the mother of Jesus and the mother of John in Revelation 12, and again, that plural indicates all of us, is explicitly revealed to be the mother of us all in Revelation 12, 17. Does that make sense, brother?
Yeah, that does. Thank you.
Oh, all right, it's a mind blower, brother, and especially if you're talking to a Protestant who knows Greek. I love talking to Protestants that know Greek because you can get a Greek New Testament and show it to them. And I can tell you, brother, so many times it's kind of an eye-opener. Mm-hmm. It was for me all those years ago. Oh, my goodness. I never saw that before.
I'm going to try to get Luke on, Kyle. Yes. So thank you very much. Luke's in Seoul, South Korea. Luke, you're going to have to be quick with your question if you'd like an answer from Tim.
Yeah.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
So, my question is this: with the current crisis in the Holy Land, this question has people have asked this question a lot.
Okay.
So, how do you explain to a non-Christian that the current Jews are the descendants of Abraham?
Yes, great question, man. And there's many ways it can be done, but one way that's simple is that when it comes to both Jews and Christians, our genealogies are everything to us. And I can tell you, brother, as one who goes to the Holy Land, I was there a year ago, and you may have heard my next pilgrimage to Israel just got canceled because of the war. But you can actually go to Israel and meet families who have lived in the Holy Land for 2,000 years. Those who say that, you know, all the Christians and all the Jews were expunged from the Holy Land, that is simply not true. There are families that are still there. There are very few of them that have been there, and they're Christians. We actually met some of them in a place called Tibiah, if I'm saying it right, Tibiah. There's only, like, I think 2,000 left, unfortunately, because of the persecutions. But in the same way with the Jews, yes, they were expulsed and numerous times and such. But not only do you have those who remained, but very importantly, the Jews, like Christians, have kept meticulous records, genealogies, and whatnot. And so even though the persecutions were terrible and fierce, those genealogies remain. And this is why, even among the Jews, even to this day, you know, you have the Cohen families that can trace their lineage back to the priesthood, for example. And there are reasons for that, because the Jews had such a great devotion to the priesthood. And Saul, it is so essential that they had to keep those genealogical lines alive. And there are Jews to this day in the Holy Land that have those genealogies, and they believe, now I don't buy this, but they believe one day that they will revitalize the temple. And that, by the way, is a little discussion that goes on amongst Catholics. There are some Catholics who believe that will happen one day, and unfortunately they're wrong, but that's not something the church has decided on. I just happen to be right. It ain't going to happen, that's all.
Luke, thank you very, very much for the call. I'm sorry we had a little trouble connecting, but I'm glad we finally got you on. Tim Staples, thank you for a very fine hour. That went really quick for me. I don't know how it was for you, but...
Too quick, brother.
Too quick.
God
all right.
Bless you.
Tomorrow, Tim's back. We'll see you then. God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.